Welcome. I'm John Kiriakou, and this is The Deep State. Here on The Deep State, we go deep into stories that the mainstream media just don't want you to know. The Deep State imprisoned me once upon a time. Well, now we're going after the Deep State. I'd like to bring on Thomas Drake. Tom is not just a longtime friend of mine. He is a former NSA senior official and a noted whistleblower. In 2001, at the time of the 9/11 attacks, well, let me back up. The number of personnel in the intelligence community is classified. We don't know what that number is. But the former Deputy Director of National Intelligence, Mary Margaret Graham, accidentally leaked the budget in something like 2003 or 2004. And the budget was $20 billion. $20 billion 22 years ago. Well, you know how budgets are made in the intelligence community, just like I do. We have to be talking about a budget of 60, 80 billion, maybe $100 billion. And if there were 20,000 or so people at the CIA, and I'm just making that number up, if there were, let's say, 20,000 in 2001, there have to be 60, 80, or 100,000 people working today. And with no meaningful reforms in the interim, it seems to me that the intelligence community in the United States is an even riskier place to work. Not riskier in that you're putting your life on the line when you go overseas, but riskier in the respect that the CIA, NSA, FBI, DIA, all these different organizations are actually working against their own people.
Well, here, to me, it's even worse. And this was already emerging in the post-Cold War era because it's a so-called peace dividend. It's like, hey, who's the enemy? We don't have an enemy anymore. So this is like, you know, we're staring at our navel, as we would say, trying to figure out who the next enemy is, not realizing that it had already emerged. You know, you go back all the airline, all the hijackers, that was staring you right in the face. But I can actually go back to the 80s and Beirut and Lebanon, you know, with the Marine Corps barracks and the French, where, you know, this is under Reagan. He didn't do anything. He actually didn't do anything. There was already that asymmetric, but see, this is the problem. You get into the institution ends up reflecting the in many respects, and this is sort of the cultural dynamic of an institution, especially in the deep state side of the government, where it begins to reflect the very enemy that it was actually created to go against.
That's right.
So it didn't really change. There was no true reform after the collapse of the Soviet Union.
No.
In 91,
because remember, there was supposed to be that peace dividend.
That's correct.
And we were going to all live happily ever after.
Yes.
And cut the budgets, and everybody was gladly giving up their budgets because peace was at hand. It was all over. Yep. And that lasted a matter of months. And the next thing you know, we're bombing the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, oops, by accident, and then 9/11 takes place. And it's never been the same.
Right, and no one, the accountability of 9/11 has been left to those who blew the whistle. That's what's happened. And of course, you know, as I know all too well, paid incredibly high price for what were considered part of the two greatest sins post 9/11 in terms of it was all unnecessary between mass surveillance and torture.
Yes.
Never mind all the corruption. See, the corruption itself hardly gets discussed because it's like, if I'm a Congress person, you know, why would I want to give up the money that's flowing into my district because I've got some defense, you know, I've got a defense, you know, whatever it is, a defense contractor who's building whatever, right?
Yes.
It'll be hardware, software, whatever. I'm not going to give that up because it's jobs and everything else. And then there's a technique where they just split it all up, right? They split it all up. Or they do this IDIQ, which is an indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity, which gives them the sort of the enhanced version of cost plus award fees. I've been executive program manager on the contract side. And then it's just open-ended, right? Because you're just giving, it just like, we're just, hey. And if you're the contractor, why would I want to actually solve it? I don't need to solve it. I don't need to do that at all. Now, on the institutional side, this is the other thing that people don't, I don't think, fully appreciate, John. I'd be curious, because when I was, interestingly enough, even when I was at NSA, we ended up going out to other parts of this, the deep state, the intelligence community, to like, 9/11 happened. It was a fundamental failure. What are you guys thinking about? Are you doing any kind of like prediction, future? Are there other ways to look at intelligence? Are there other ways to bring it all together? What we kept running into, though, and even when you talk to others in their own respective agencies, guess what word would keep coming up as a reason why we can't? I'm going to give you a really key example about why it became so difficult prior to 9/11, but became really evident even after 9/11, despite all the attempts to do fusion centers and everything else. Equity, equity issues, this weird word called equity, that if I have data, if I have intelligence and I share it, and this is just this really, it's just really this perverse way of looking at it. If I give it to you, John, so I have this information and I give it to you, I don't know what you're going to do with it, which disincentivizes me from even giving you the information in the first place. But wait a minute, information, this is the coin of the realm. If I don't have the information, how can I then take action on it? How can I combine it with other intelligence? I don't know all the ints. I don't know whether it's SIGINT, ELINT, HUMINT, MAZINT, you name it, right? I mean, RUMINT, it doesn't matter. Okay. I need all of it. And I remember when I was at CIA, here's my CIA vignette for you. I was assigned to the DI, okay? The Director of Intelligence. I was actually in the science and technology side of the DI. Guess what my primary focus was, down to what was then NPIC, imagery analysis.
Oh, yeah. IMINT. Yeah, National Photographic
of all imagery analysis, right? Building 213. I was doing analysis on weapons of mass destruction. I'm looking at a picture, literally looking at a picture, and because of my background at NSA, right, operational out on the edge during the Cold War, I remember, and I had multiple phones in front of me with different colors, okay? And you can smile because you will remember there were different color phones.
The green one, the beige one, the red one.
Brown, that's right, beige, the beige phone, right.
Right.
I remember, because to get equity, I said, I need to call, and it was a former military colleague I flew with, who is now assigned to a specialized unit NSA. And he would probably have information that might correlate to what I was looking at in terms of weapons of mass destruction. And they actually said, why would you want to call him?
Oh.
I said, all I see is a picture. All I see is a picture. I have no other intelligence. I need something that shows intent, that there might be some communication, whether it's electronic, a signature, electronic signature, a sensor, or actual communications with real people talking about what I'm looking at.
Oh, Tom, I worked
and
for
then
a guy.
But then they wonder, I was issuing reports. It's like, how did you know that? I said, I picked up the
phone
and called my colleague.
Exactly.
At NSA.
I worked for a guy when I first joined the Director of Intelligence. It's kind of a similar story. Yeah, I mean, similar. And when he was a young analyst, he made a name for himself. This was in the midst of the Vietnam War. He made a name for himself because he was working for the National Photographic Interpretation Center, NPIC, and he's looking at this satellite photo of North Vietnamese jungle. But he notices that they've just started to clear some trees, like they're going to start to pave a road. So he says, aha, the North Vietnamese, they're building a road. That road probably goes to China. So he immediately writes a report for the president's daily brief, like his hair is on fire. And he says, the North Vietnamese are building a road and it looks like it's going to China. So every day for years, he followed the construction of this road and it went to China. And every couple of weeks, he would write an update for the president First, it was President Johnson, then it was President Nixon, about the construction of this big road that's going from Hanoi all the way up to China. And then years pass, and we become friends with the North Vietnamese, well, the Vietnamese. And he's invited onto a liaison visit. Come to North Vietnam, we're going to shake hands, we're going to take pictures, we'll give you a tour, and then we're friends. So he meets a full general, a four-star Vietnamese general, and he says to him, "General, I have to ask you, this road that you built from Hanoi to China, everybody in the government was worried, upset, nervous about this road. What was this road?" And the general says, "What? We didn't have a road. We needed a road, so we built one. That was it." Hundreds of millions of dollars went into coverage of this road. It's the same thing with technology. It's the same thing post 9/11, but on a grander scale. The American taxpayers are being bled while all of this money is being wasted. And we don't even have any idea what, for example, DARPA is working on. And they're supposed to be 20 years, 30, 50 years ahead of, you know, all the rest of us. I don't know how this is tenable.
In the military.
Yeah.
It's not. It's not sustainable because you're basically bankrupting debt financing. Remember, we're spending about $2 trillion extra every year than what we're bringing in as an income in terms of the government. It's unsustainable. I mean, I don't know how they're saying what's the limit in terms of the national debt. And as long as they keep kicking the can down the road, but we're talking literally about a fifth now of our entire budget is going to service the debt alone.
That's right. And then
no one wants to do anything about it.
And then the Pentagon budget is going to take another 50%.
Yeah, as if more money.
I actually
remember when Doge was around. Doge.
Sure. Yeah.
I actually proposed, never got any traction. It was basically a direct message to Doge and Musk, who led Doge at that time. And you know, the Department of Government Efficiency. I mean, it's just Doge. I mean, it was a play on words in terms of the acronym. Mm-hmm. You know what I proposed? I said, you want to cut a couple trillion out of the budget? Easy. And I started naming the waste, fraud, abuse, and you don't need a trillion or 800 at the time, 800 plus billion dollar defense budget. It's not about more money. It's just not at all. But my experience was it was Skunk Works teams
with
very little money who had a far greater in terms of sort of the ratio. What did you create that made a difference or the impact or the result from less money, not more money?
That's right.
But that's not, see, this is what Eisenhower warned the nation about. It's just unsustainable. I mean, you're talking, we need more. What happened to all the money? Remember, this is a problem I had at NSA. NSA never passed an audit. There was an attempt made by someone brought in from the outside who I was partnered with trying to audit NSA's budget. Remember, you have the sort of the allocated, the appropriations, what's appropriate, authorized, the authorizers, and then what's appropriated. And so that ultimately ends up in a bill, which ultimately, you know, the legislation goes before the president signs it into law. There's mechanism, of course, you know, under generally accepted accounting practices. There's okay.
Right.
To keep track of all that. NSA did not want anybody to keep track of that, let alone anybody coming in from the outside. They wanted to keep it down below basically sort of the main expenditure, what they call expenditure centers. They didn't really want any accountability below that.
Yeah.
Because that's where all the game playing was.
Yes.
Now go to the Pentagon. Pentagon has never, ever been audited successfully.
No, never.
We don't know.
Trillions of dollars.
Vast, staggering amounts of money. Staggering. For what?
Yeah,
I mean, this reminds me of the Roman Empire, right? It does. You're collapsing from within, but then you're projecting your power because there's got to be sort of like within Orwell, the mix historical metaphors. Oceania is always at war with somebody. You know, I remember the period in the early 90s. It's really interesting. I was a crypto linguist when I was in the Air Force, electronic warfare specialist. There was a very brief period after the Cold War. So I had been out a couple of years, but I was in the Navy, right? I was down at the Pentagon in the Alert Center, in the NIMCIC, the Joint Intelligence Center. A whole nother interesting chapter in my military life. But I remember I stayed in touch because, you know, it's a small fraternity of flyers. And I flew for, you know, I was on flight status for like 7+ years.
Right.
And there was Open Skies. You may remember Open Skies is a program in which we exchanged. Crews would actually fly over. This is between Russia, no longer Soviet Union, Russia and the United States. They would fly their flights, right? Verification flights. We would fly ours. They would get together. They would have socials.
Yeah.
I remember we were like, quote unquote, adversaries during the Cold War. I remember some really interesting conversations that I had with my fellow Russian crypto linguists. And they had like specialized in Russian. So they were, I wouldn't call them fluent, but they had gone through all the advanced courses and everything else. So they could actually, you know, carry on even technically with their counterparts. They said, what a wasted opportunity. That we had far more, this was the bottom line, there was far more in common post-Cold War than there were differences. Despite historical enmity, despite all the contradictions, despite all of that. And, you know, you can cite, you know, you mentioned Vietnam. People have gone back and have made friends with former enemies. They've had, you know, in some cases have these reunions, special reunions. They did this even after World War II. You know, they find out the guy that tried to shoot me down becomes my best friend in later years.
That's right.
Right.
That's absolutely
so
true.
So it's there that gives me hope on a human level, but there's clearly forces, and I'm going to say it this way: forces at large. They don't want cooperation. They don't want what's best for the general welfare. Right. For all. Whether it's U.S. or anybody else, divide, the split, partisanship, create enemies. And this is kind of, we're sort of in this endless cycle now.
I'm sorry, no, go ahead. I wanted to ask you a question.
Sure.
It's we've talked about this high-level financial/procurement debacle that takes place in government now. Trillions of dollars missing from the Pentagon, trillions of dollars missing collectively over the years at CIA and at NSA and elsewhere. Gigantic, unsustainable national debt. People ask me all the time in interviews, mostly young people, they ask me about spy gadgets. And I always say, I know it doesn't sound very sexy, but 9/10 of spy gadgets, we just buy on Amazon. Because there's no sense in reinventing the wheel when you can just go on Amazon.com and buy, you know, the little spy pen with the camera in it, or the tracker that you can put under your, you know, cheating wife's car, or whatever it happens to be. But then, with those systems or pieces of equipment that you really do have to invent from scratch, they can cost tens of millions or even hundreds of millions of dollars. We're talking about advanced systems, satellites and rockets and all kinds of crazy things. Software like Pegasus, for example. How do procurement incentives then distort the adoption of surveillance and analytics technologies? Or are the two compatible in the end?
The bottom line for me, it's a for-profit enterprise.
I have to agree.
There is. So the incentive is not to reduce. The incentive is actually expand. You cannot get enough. I remember the mantra at NSA. First, it was, let's instrument everything. Basically, just put sensors. That was sort of the Hayden philosophy was, we're just going to own the net. General Alexander comes along.
Yep.
He was a successor to Hayden. And he literally said at a site in overseas, why can't we collect it all?
Mm-hmm. Unbelievable.
And there it is right there. Why can't we collect it all?
But then, Tom, even if you collect it all, what the heck do you do with it all?
You never know, you might need it. This is where you get into the control, tracking, monitor regime. This is a surveillance state, but it's becomes a national surveillance state, and it becomes transnational when you're talking all these under the table arrangements with other companies from other, they're incentivized to sell. You just sell surveillance for control and monitoring and tracking. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll give you one example that's now become a local issue in the United States, which is the Flock cameras. And they're far than just cameras.
Yes, yes, yes.
The Flock cameras, tens of thousands of these now are being set up. And these are not just traffic cameras, as people have mistaken. These are definitely surveillance cameras. Traffic cameras is one thing. You bust through, you get a picture, it gets sent to you, you pay a fine or you get a warning, right?
Right.
Right. We're talking something far more insidious, because you literally, it's a mesh. It's set up as a mesh. And they're now being put up in neighborhoods, right? Suburban neighborhoods. Which means you can literally, and this is the Orwell, this is the dystopian future that's incredibly Orwellian. Speaking of Winston, when you have this level of persistent surveillance of all kinds, then, hey, I don't need to have a policeman on the corner.
Right.
I don't. I don't even need to have, like they did in East Germany, that was the country in which I specialized during the Cold War.
Yeah.
We didn't even need to have the Mitarbeiters. You don't even need to have people cooperating by snitching on your neighbors, quote unquote. No, I just have this very active network of surveillance just throughout society, and it keeps track of just about everything.
But then in any normal situation, you're going to have a human being reviewing the play-by-play here, reviewing when algorithms are used in intelligence or algorithms are used in law enforcement operations, right? There's got to be human intervention.
With AI, increasingly, and this is what's happening, and I'm increasingly involved, there's this whole other concern with AI where you have autonomous warfare, automated weapons, where you literally are increasingly leaving the person out of the loop because the decisions that it's making don't even allow for human intervention. You're just seeding the algorithm. You're seeding the decisions over to the algorithm. You're letting them select the targets.
Yeah.
Remember, it's a target-rich environment. If you want to select on people, person, you want to select on all cars, no matter what, because you can capture their license plates. You want to also collect on any other signal that may be coming from the car, including devices inside the car, including phones. Because remember, every phone is a tracking device.
Yeah.
Well, hey, literally, it's all there. So then what? Right? I mean, remember, I'm going to bring it all the way back around, John. People tell me, I don't care. I don't care what the government knows because I'm not doing anything wrong.
You know, you're the one who taught me that the first person to pose that question in a public venue was Joseph Goebbels in 1936. Yep. And that still sends chills up my spine.
But it's also an excuse to keep collecting it all. And it's this Leviathan of surveillance, this surveillance system machine, right? Yeah. Can never get enough. And remember, in today's world, because so much has been digitized, there's far more, more and more data is being generated each and every day. So, I mean, this is like, it's like trying to suck the ocean dry. I mean, it's just staggering amounts of digital data.
Yes.
And the government's just spending vast amounts of money. Remember, all these people companies aren't turning this data over for free to the government. This is not like, what's good for America, it's good for America, it's good for General Motors. The old phrase, during World War II. Yeah, that was, you talk about patriotism because you're dealing with fascism, right? And out of control autocrats in other parts of the world. in terms of the Axis powers, right, during World War II. This is going far beyond that. It's all profit driven, right? What the heck? If the government's willing to spend, you know, I made this argument back in 2011 at a conference out in San Francisco. I said, you're just selling data to the government. And there was just absolute silence. They didn't want to admit that at the corporate level, they're willing to sell out third party doctrine, sell out subscriber information. There's their customer data to the government.
Just scandalous. One last question for you. We talked earlier about the oversight committees and really the lack of oversight that that exists in government.
Undersight
committees. How should public agencies be overseen? How is it even possible, for example, for the Senate Intelligence Committee, which has, let's say, 60 employees, let's say they've expanded since I was on Capitol Hill, they have 80 employees. How is it possible for them to oversee the day-to-day operations of an organization or an intelligence community with 100,000 employees and a budget of, you know, $100 billion plus?
They can't. I can give you a vignette. General Hayden, I'm in executive session. He says, I don't care about any staffers. I don't care about any of the committee members. It's the only person I worry about is a chair. At the time, as Porter Goss. That was the only person he worried about.
Wow. That says a lot.
I remember committee chairs that begin to be given enormous power as well.
Enormous. Yes.
Way beyond what, I mean, this is, again, its own corruption within the institution of Congress. So, and I know I had someone that used to work with me who ultimately, he himself had acknowledged, he was in a liaison position. He said the entire set of oversight committees are all co-opted.
Thanks for being with us today, Tom. And thank you for watching. This is the Deep State. And remember, keep asking the questions the government wants you to ignore. I'm John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.